Good morning, everyone, and welcome once again to the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Calgary. I'm the Reverend Derwin Kostanak, the priest of the parish, and once again, I'd like to welcome you to this sermon video. We are now in the third Sunday after the Epiphany and into the third sermon in this series that we are doing for this season. 2 weeks ago, we began an approach to the gospel readings that are assigned to us in the lectionary for Epiphany. And the idea is that we would read through these gospel passages and explore them as though we were there and meeting Jesus for the first time. The challenge here being to let go of our understanding of how the story develops, trying to pretend that we knew nothing at all beforehand, and what would we discover about Jesus in each of these episodes. So by way of example, 2 weeks ago, the very first Sunday, we looked at Jesus' baptism and compared all four accounts in all four Gospels. And we came to the conclusion that had we been there, chances are really, really good that we wouldn't have noticed anything special about Jesus when he was baptized. Maybe we saw a bird land on him or something. And then since he left from there and then ended up going north to Galilee, if we were living in Judea around Jerusalem at the time, it might have been months, even a year or two before we ever saw him again. So we wouldn't have learned anything at his baptism. But because we were paying attention to John the Baptizer and he said that one would come after him who was greater than him, the challenge for us was then that we would keep our hearts open and keep our eyes peeled for this one, that we would be still anticipating this person that John was talking about, and so keeping things open for the arrival and revelation of that one. Last week, we talked about John chapter 2 and the wedding of Cana, the wedding at Cana in Galilee, where Jesus performed this miraculous sign of turning water into wine. It was only attested in the Gospel of John, so we couldn't look at any other by way of comparison. But the main point that we saw there was that the only people that would have known that that had happened, that that miracle had taken place, would have been Jesus and his mother, of course, but then his four disciples who were with him and the servants who delivered the water that was turned into wine to the chief steward. We saw that the disciples, as a result of seeing this, believed in Jesus, or better, put their trust in Jesus. And of course, part of that would be because they'd already known Jesus for at least 3 days, having traveled with him from the south up into Galilee. And so this sign just helped nail it down for them. But interestingly, nothing is said about what effect it had on the servants. They didn't know anything about Jesus before he came. All they saw was this amazing trick, something that no doubt gave them something to talk about, but it did not lead them to faith. And so our conclusion was to recognize that what we learn about Jesus and coming to understand him involves taking all the pieces and putting them together and finding that these things combined lead us to realize that Jesus is someone worth paying attention to. So those are the last 2 weeks. Now, today, we are going to explore the account of Jesus preaching in the synagogue in his hometown of Nazareth. This is from the Gospel of Luke. And because the synagogue had such a significant influence on the development of Christian liturgy, I thought it'd be appropriate today then to wear my alb, to wear my liturgical robe, just recognizing that what we're talking about is happening in a public place of worship. So let's get into that today. I'm going to read the gospel and then we'll start exploring what it is that we can learn about Jesus from this episode. So this is the Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to St. Luke, beginning with chapter 4, verse 16. When Jesus came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. Then he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. They said, "Is not this Joseph's son?" He said to them, "Doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, 'Doctor, cure yourself.' And you will say, 'Do here also in your hometown the things that we have heard you did at Capernaum.' And he said, 'Truly I tell you, no prophet is accepted in the prophet's hometown. But the truth is, there were many widows in Israel in the time of Elijah, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, and there was a severe famine over all the land. Yet Elijah was sent to none of them except to a widow at Zarephath in Sidon. There were also many lepers in Israel at the time of the prophet Elisha, and none of them was cleansed except Naaman the Syrian." When they heard this, all in the synagogue were filled with rage. They got up, drove him out of the town, and led him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built, so that they might hurl him off the cliff. But he passed through the midst of them and went on his way. The Gospel of Christ. Those of you who are really attentive will recognize that that was a longer reading than was actually assigned today. And yes, it's true. I've taken this week's gospel reading as well as next week's gospel reading and put them together just so we can look at the entire passage, the entire event. I'll choose another episode in Jesus' life for next week's sermon. But so we took a look at this passage, this entire episode happening at his hometown. Now, just by way of background into this, it is helpful for us to compare again with the other Gospels. This episode does not appear in the Gospel of John at all, so we're only looking at the Synoptic Gospels. And what's interesting about how Luke approaches this passage is he brings this up very early on in Jesus' ministry. What we find out actually is there's only one or two verses between Jesus' baptism and temptation for 40 days in the wilderness before we get here. What we read is that after Jesus left the wilderness and his 40 days of fasting, then Jesus, filled with the power of the Spirit, returned to Galilee, and a report about him spread throughout all the surrounding country. He began to teach in their synagogues and was praised by everyone. When he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and so on and so forth. So what you find is this is put right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry for Luke. But that verse or two in between could be of varying lengths of time. Indeed, when we look at the Gospel of Mark, this episode doesn't happen until chapter 6. And in a book that's only 16 chapters long, that's pretty far into the story, especially thinking that Mark doesn't cover anything to do with Jesus' birth or his childhood. So in Mark, we find that Jesus, after his baptism and after his temptation, got into ministry, was healing people, raising people from the dead or someone who was close to death, delivering people from demons, cleansing lepers, teaching, preaching, having controversy with the Pharisees, all in the region of Galilee for some time before he gets to his hometown of Nazareth. Similarly, in the Gospel of Matthew, we read about him coming to Nazareth in chapter 13, which in a book of 28 chapters is almost halfway through. And like Mark, we see all of these different things going on before Jesus ever sets foot in his hometown. Now, curiously, Matthew does say something about Nazareth right after Jesus' baptism and temptation. He goes up into Galilee and basically opts out of parking it in Nazareth and moving on to Capernaum to make that his headquarters. And the reason for that, Matthew says, was to fulfill the scriptures. And he quotes something from the Old Testament speaking about why this would be important. So it's interesting, Matthew has Jesus leave Nazareth in favor of Capernaum to fulfill scriptures, but he still goes out and does a lot of things before coming back to Nazareth. Mark simply has Jesus doing a bunch of things before he ever shows up in Nazareth, but Luke doesn't make much of all those things, gets Jesus to Nazareth fairly quickly, and then because of what happened in this episode, that becomes the explanation as to why he goes to Capernaum and makes that his base of operations. So once again, we remind ourselves that all of the gospel writers had a different slant, a different approach that they wanted to take in telling the story of Jesus, different reasons for writing, and different reasons for structuring the book the way they did. So for our purposes today, looking at the Gospel of Luke, what we know at the very least is that Jesus has been out in Galilee, he's been going around to different places, different synagogues and teaching, and after some undetermined period of time, he is now back in Nazareth. Now, what happens when he comes into Nazareth? What would we notice if we were there? Well, once again, we'd have to be a resident of Nazareth, this little one-horse town in Galilee where everybody knows everybody else and everybody's business is everybody's business and all of this. And so what we would have known, of course, is that this man named Jesus had left Nazareth some time ago to go and check out John the Baptizer down in Judea near Jerusalem. We don't know how long ago that was. We're not told in the scriptures. It could have been a few months, maybe a year. We don't know. But Jesus left and went and spent time with John the Baptizer. And now perhaps we've gotten wind that Jesus was back up in the north part of the country. But nevertheless, he has now arrived in Nazareth, in his hometown. And we read that he goes to the synagogue. So chances are good he didn't arrive on the Sabbath, because the practice of the Jews at that time was to walk no more than a quarter of a mile just to avoid working on the Sabbath. So Jesus's travel day was probably the day before, and now it's the Sabbath day, and the first thing that we recognize about Jesus is he's still really Jewish. He went to the synagogue as was his custom. This is what you did back then, and this is what Jesus did too. And so he comes to the synagogue, and this is where he gathers with the people of Nazareth to enter into a time of worship and instruction, because that's what you do on the Sabbath. You go to synagogue. If you're not close to Jerusalem and you can't get to the temple, you go to the synagogue instead. Now, the interesting thing about the synagogue, and I think this is important for us to be aware of, is that not only, as I mentioned earlier, was it the inspiration for the form of Christian worship, but it operates a little, it operated a little bit differently back then than it does today, especially in comparison to Christian churches today, but even to modern Jewish temples and synagogues. And that is that back in Jesus's day, the way that the synagogue service went was far more communal. Yes, there were people in charge of the synagogue. There were those responsible for making it run and administering it. But it's not like there was like a professional clergy that was responsible for doing everything. That did develop over time. But back in Jesus's day, the way it worked is on the Sabbath, you would have the intention that people would gather for worship, and you had to, first of all, establish a minyan before you could have a synagogue service. Now, minyan, it's not minyan, as in a little insignificant person or whatever. It's not minyan, it's minyan, which basically meant that you had to have 10 Jewish men at minimum present before you could have a synagogue service. And once those men had gathered, then the people responsible for administering the synagogue would assign roles for different men to play in the service. And so one person would be responsible for the prayers, and the prayers were how the service opened. And there were a number of formal, already written prayers, at least six that were used, as well as opportunity for extemporaneous prayers. And so this one member of the Jewish community would lead in those prayers. And then when the prayers were done, they would go to the reading of the Torah, and there would be seven readings from the Torah. And each one of those seven readings would be read by a different man from the community. And so the administrator of the synagogue would say, okay, we want you to do the first reading, and you could do the second reading and the third reading. And of course, nobody would have a problem with this, because it would always be an honor to read the Torah. And so the seven sections of the Torah would be read. And then it would come time for the reading of the prophet. And once again, another man in the crowd would be asked if he would go ahead and read from the prophet. Of course, this is when Jesus finally gets to read in this passage. And then there would be someone who would preach. And it's interesting that the sermon was not the main event. In fact, it was optional. Much like if you were to read the Book of Common Prayer or the Book of Alternative Services for the Anglican Church of Canada and look at our liturgy for morning prayer and evening prayer, you would find that it simply says that a sermon may be preached. It wasn't an essential part of the service. Now, obviously, it's become an important part, and it certainly became important in synagogue worship too, that somebody would talk about those scriptures that they read, that would unpack them and help explain them for the people. And so someone from the crowd would also be asked if they might share some reflections or say something about the readings for the day. And evidently Jesus was asked to do both, reading the prophet and providing the sermon. Now, I say all of that to say that I think it's important for us to realize that Jesus was not the featured guest speaker in this synagogue service. That's not how synagogues worked. The sermon wasn't the main event back then. And so the idea that somehow we had a celebrity in our midst, let's have them preach for us, really wasn't the thing. Now, let me simply say that, yes, if there was a rabbi traveling through town and he happened to come in to join in the worship, it would be logical for the leader of the synagogue to invite the rabbi to say a few words. But it's not like there was an arrangement here that somehow the flyers went out advertising, hey, we got Jesus preaching at our synagogue. No, not at all. Especially since he's back in his hometown. He's just back now with people that he's lived with for years, and he's included in the worship, and so he was asked if he would do a reading like he would have been asked before, and asked if he would preach like he probably had been asked before, like any other man in the congregation. And so the only thing that's really special about this one might be that it had been a while since he was in Nazareth, so they get to hear from him again. And so with that setup, Jesus then doesn't do anything remarkable. It's his turn. He takes the scroll from the attendant, opens up. He was given the scroll of Isaiah. He opens up to Isaiah 61. Maybe that's what his intention. It's hard to say that there was an assigned reading at this point, but nevertheless, that's what he reads. And then he rolls up the scroll, hands it back to the attendant, and sits down. Nothing remarkable about that because that's what you do. And you would sit down if you're the one who's going to do the teaching, do the sermon. And then it says that everyone's eyes were fixed on Jesus. But even that is an unremarkable statement. It's not like they heard him read and go, okay, what is this guy going to say? It's just that's what you do. Like when I get up to preach, when we're gathered for worship, pretty much everybody's eyes are fixed on me. Not because I'm anybody special, but because I'm about to speak and you pay attention to the person who's speaking. So nothing unusual is happening here. And then it says that Jesus began to say to them, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. Now it's important here to understand that Luke has really compressed the account of what has happened in the synagogue service. It is not like Jesus read the scroll, rolled it up, handed it to the attendant, sat down, and then said, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. And then suddenly everybody starts to speak well of him and think they're kind of amazed at his gracious words and all that. No, what's happened is he would have spoken for what, 10 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour? We don't know. The idea is that that particular sentence was the topic of what he was preaching about. That for all that he had to say, the bottom line is that he was saying that Isaiah 61 was being fulfilled in their hearing. So when he was done saying all of that, then we start to see the response of the people. And it said that all spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. And so there's a rather positive response as Jesus is preaching. Well, sure. I mean, the passage he's reading is pretty positive. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor, to proclaim release from the captives, recovery of sight to the blind. The passage itself is already really positive. And evidently, Jesus was saying really good things about it. But then, after they had had this initial response, they then asked the question, is this not Joseph's son? They're putting two and two together and or at least making that observation. Now, in Luke, we are not told how they said that. They could have been saying, isn't this Joseph's son? Like, this is amazing that he can speak so well. Who would have thought? You know, the guy that grew up as a carpenter, you know? Or it could have been, isn't this Joseph's son? How does he think that he can speak like this? Chances are, their statement was more along those lines than the previous thing I suggested. In Matthew and Mark, we're told an even more compressed version of the story. And there, when they bring up that point, hey, isn't this Joseph's son? Hey, we know his mother's Mary and doesn't he have these four brothers and all of his sisters are here? And it says, and they took offense at him. There's no mention that they took offense yet in Luke, but it's very clear that they're going to. What happens next in this account is also very compressed. In fact, it's very difficult to follow because it just goes too quickly. You don't see anything coming. You know, so they spoke well of him and they said, "Is this not Joseph's son?" And he said to them, "Doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, doctor, cure yourself. And then do here in your hometown what you did in Capernaum." And then he brings up how in Elijah and Elisha's day that even though there were needy Israelites, God didn't touch the needy Israelites. He instead was helping out foreigners, you know. Like, suddenly Jesus seems to be really aggressive. And in the middle of all of that, he says, "Truly I tell you, no prophet is welcome in his hometown." Like, when you're reading this passage, it happens so fast, you're thinking, how does this happen? Well, again, it's a compression of what has developed. So evidently what has happened is after Jesus has been talking, people are saying, "Wait a sec, something doesn't quite seem right for us here." So here's the question. If we were there, what would we have seen? What would we have understood about Jesus? And I'm going to suggest to you that we would have responded in exactly the same way that everybody else did. Now, we would like to think that we wouldn't, but why would we like to think that we wouldn't have responded that way? Well, the reason is because we know how this story is supposed to go. So we would not want to think that we would be among those who would reject Jesus from the beginning. I mean, especially with how violently they did. They were so upset. They were just filled with rage because of what he said. They went and drove him out and then threw him down a cliff. Basically, they're getting ready to stone him, right? And it's easier to stone somebody when they're in the lower ground. And Jesus ends up just leaving them. And that's when he takes off to Capernaum. But I mean, with that kind of a response, we wouldn't like to think that we would have responded that way. But why wouldn't we? We don't know how this story is supposed to go. So let's just revisit what we're discovering about Jesus here. I mean, let's not forget that if we were there, we would remember when Jesus was like this tall, right? And we saw him grow up and we saw him learn his father's trade. Who knows? Maybe you taught him the Torah when he went to shul on Sabbath and you were the one responsible for helping him understand the scriptures and learn the Torah like every Jewish boy would learn. And then when you find out that this carpenter, this builder, decides that he's going to leave town for a bit to check out John the Baptizer and is gone for a few months, however long it is. And then he comes back. And now, yeah, like any other man in the minyan would be asked to, he gets to read the scriptures and even talk about them for a bit. But now he starts talking like he's a rabbi or something. And how could he go from being a carpenter to a rabbi in such a short time? Normally, to be a rabbi, you would have to be the disciple of another rabbi for a number of years before you got to the place that you might go out on your own and be a rabbi. And here Jesus was gone for what, less than a year? And now he comes back holding himself and conducting himself like he's a rabbi. And then even taking our precious scriptures and pointing out things that are saying that we ought not to think that we're automatically going to be favored by God because we're Israelites. Hang on a second. Who does this guy think he is? You see, the problem with the people in Nazareth and what they saw about Jesus is that they already knew Jesus. They were already convinced. They understood who this guy was. They saw him grow up. And they said, "This carpenter isn't a rabbi. He ought not to be carrying on the way that he is. Yeah, he started off fine, and obviously he can talk good and this kind of thing, but he's just a carpenter. My kids went to school with his. We've played together. I've had him over my house. And now he's saying something that is meant to challenge me about my approach as one of God's people? Hang on. That's just too much." And I would suggest that we would be just the same. It's a hard thing to hear, to imagine that that would be our response. But isn't that exactly what we're trying to do here with this series? Trying to see who Jesus is without knowing the end from the beginning? Without knowing how the story turns out? We're doing something that's kind of like meeting Jesus for the first time, stolen from a title of a book by Marcus Borg from 2009, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time. I mean, that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to see what would our first time meetings and encounters with Jesus be like. And the bottom line is this. If, like the people of Nazareth, we felt that we already know Jesus, then when Jesus is portrayed as doing something or saying something or exploring something or challenging us with something, it doesn't fit well with us. And we start to think, no, that can't be. What is it that hurts us the most when we encounter these revelations of Jesus that makes it so difficult for us to accept? I would suggest to you that what does that most deeply is when something we encounter about Jesus challenges the way that we think, the way that we think about Jesus, the way that we think about our lives, something that challenges us in the way that we're supposed to live or the way that we should speak or the way that we should act, especially towards others. When we encounter information about Jesus that challenges what we already figure we have figured out, that's when we find the reason to resist it and to think, no, it can't be that way. That's not the Jesus I know, or that's not what really would be expected. And I would want to encourage you this morning to resist the urge to do that. As you encounter these episodes about Jesus and look at them with fresh eyes and try to listen for what is being said in a new way, and perhaps even as this passage does, puts ourselves in a rather unflattering light, do not resist and reject the perspective, but be willing to embrace that and think, what if this is so? What difference would it make for me to take this approach about what Jesus said or what Jesus did or who Jesus is said to be and what is being said about me? Let us really work hard and not pushing it aside and distancing ourselves from that, but just simply saying, what if we were to go deeply into that? What would come out? What would we discover? If the people in Nazareth had not so quickly pushed Jesus away because they didn't like what they saw in him, their story would be different than what it was, wouldn't it? And there would be a different approach to Jesus' ministry in Galilee in general, and certainly in Nazareth in particular. Let's allow room for Jesus to surprise us and to challenge us and to cause us to think more deeply about the one in whom we put our trust. Amen.